This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. United Nations inspectors arrived on Wednesday in the southern Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia on a mission to prevent a nuclear accident at a Russian-occupied power plant where nearby shelling has prompted global fears of disaster. The International Atomic Energy Agency team reached the city 55 kilometers away from the plant, where they were likely to spend the night before arriving at the facility on Thursday, although Russian installed officials suggested the visit might last only one day. The IAEA hopes for longer. Russia captured the nuclear plant, Europe's largest, in early March. Its military force has been there ever since. FBI cyber experts from the U.S. are heading to Montenegro to investigate a massive and coordinated attack on the tiny Balkan nation's government and its services. Get more on the story from AP correspondent Charles de la Desma.
Last weekend, Montenegro's Agency for National Security said the country was under a hybrid war at the moment, blaming the attack squarely on Russia, though without providing evidence. Officials say Russia has a strong motive because the Balkan state, once considered an ally, joined NATO in 2017, despite strong opposition from the Kremlin. It has also joined Western recent sanctions against Moscow. Other Eastern European states deemed enemies of Russia have recently also sustained cyber attacks. I'm Charles de la Desma.
More than 50,000 monkeypox cases have been recorded in the global outbreak, the World Health Organization figures showed Wednesday, though transmission is slowing in the virus hotspots of Europe and the United States. For more news, join us at voanews.com by remote. This is VOA News. The United Nations said in a new report that at least 50 civilians were killed during a military operation conducted by Mali's army and foreign troops on April 19th. The UN has repeatedly accused Malian soldiers of summarily executing civilians and suspected militants over the course of their decade-long fight against groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. The alleged April massacre took place on Market Day in Hombori municipality, after a Malian military convoy hit an improvised explosive device. Mali's military spokesman did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Well, New York City is hosting gun-free zone signs in Times Square to alert people about new laws in the wake of the Supreme Court's concealed carrying rule. We get more on that story from AP correspondent Julie Walker.
New York's new laws take effect Thursday and will bar guns from an expanded Times Square and a long list of other so-called sensitive locations. Mayor Eric Adams says the Supreme Court decision opens another river feeding the sea of gun violence.
We're going to continue to use our laws to dam the rivers.
Governor Kathy Hochul says the SCOTUS ruling allowing concealed carry creates havoc and enforcement will be a challenge, but police will prevail.
The question will be for law enforcement to make a determination on whether or not that person has a legal concealed carry permit outside the places we've identified.
Lawsuits have been filed challenging the new law. Julie Walker, New York.
An 83-year-old nun is released after 5 months in captivity. We get more on that story from the AP's Walter Radliff.
An 83-year-old missionary nun from Louisiana has been released nearly 5 months after she was kidnapped from her bed in the West African country of Burkina Faso. A letter sent to the Maronites of Holy Cross said Sister Suellen Tennyson was free and in U.S. hands in Niger's capital. An order leader said Tennyson was kidnapped in the middle of the night on April 4th. She had worked in Burkina Faso since 2014. Her kidnapping came at a time of escalating violence and jihadi attacks in the country. I'm Walter Radliff.
Residents in southern Pakistan used sandbags to shield their homes from surging floodwaters that inundated a major highway on Wednesday as global aid began arriving with food, medicine, and tents to alleviate a major national disaster. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Reporting by remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Today is Thursday, September 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chin Adolfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, UN nuclear inspectors arrive in Ukraine amid reports of fresh strikes near the Zaporizhzhia plant.
According to Rossi, they are planning to examine the real situation there and to help to stabilize the situation as much as possible.
A new British Prime Minister emerges next week, nearly 2 months after the resignation of Boris Johnson.
Conservative Party members will choose his successor, former Chancellor Rishi Sunak, or current Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who polls suggest is the overwhelming favourite.
And more reactions to the death of former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The United States says it has determined that Russia is suffering, quote, severe manpower shortages, unquote, in its six-month-old war with Ukraine, and that it has become more desperate in its effort to find new troops to send to the front lines. A U.S. official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss a downgraded American intelligence findings says Russia is looking to address the shortage of troops in part by compelling soldiers wounded earlier in war to return to combat. It is also recruiting personnel from private security companies and even recruiting from prisons. UN nuclear inspectors from the IAEA are in the city of Zaporizhzhia, where they will spend the night before visiting the plant, which is on territory controlled by Russia on Thursday. This as Russia and Ukraine Wednesday traded accusations of launching fresh strikes near a nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine that has drawn international concern about safety amid the conflict. Reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv updates Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller on this, as well as a visit by U.S. senators to the capital.
According to Rossi, they are planning to examine the real situation there and to help to stabilize the situation as much as possible. Also, according to him, the mission plans to spend several days at the station, including talking with the staff and reporting on the results of the trip. And also, the organization intends to establish a permanent representation at the station. However, according to the so-called head of the Zaporizhzhia Regional State Administration, which was appointed by the Russian forces, he said that the program of visit is designed for just one day. And he said that basically everything which would be needed is supposed to be provided to the mission. But he also said that Russian forces which are present at the station, they are ready to show the evidence of shelling of the plant by Ukraine and to provide testimony of local residents on the territory of the nuclear power plant. And according to him, the International Atomic Energy Agency mission should go to the nuclear power plant through the city of Vasilivka in the Zaporizhzhia region, which is at the moment under the control of the Russian forces. So they want this route to be confirmed. We don't know if this route is confirmed.
I also wanted to ask you, because you had the opportunity recently to speak with U.S. Senators Amy Klobuchar and Robert Portman in Kyiv.
It was very nice to see the senators in Kyiv. The main conversation was about Ukrainian actions and Ukrainian counteroffensive actions in the Kherson region. We were talking about, in general, about how the senators see this and how they assess Ukrainian fight and Ukrainian efforts in using all the military equipment provided by the U.S. and international partners. Let's listen to what Senator Klobuchar had to say.
Well, it's very clear that Ukraine has shown the world that they're not giving up, and in fact, they're going to win this one way or another.
And now let's listen to Senator Portman.
We think that Russia has committed war crimes all over this country. Some of those war crimes have been publicized by you. Thank you for Voice of America, because when you are targeting civilians, when you are firing on hospitals and schools, these are war crimes. So I personally believe that these are effectively acts of terror, and that state sponsor of terrorism is appropriate for being committed. So we have to work that out.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller. World leaders and diplomats are reacting to the death of Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union, who died at the age of 91 on Tuesday. Western leaders remember him as the man who opened up the former Soviet bloc, created the conditions for ending the Cold War, and nurtured peace in several African countries experiencing civil wars. VOA's Carol Van Damme asked Ambassador Johnny Carson, the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs, to compare and contrast the Soviet Union during the Gorbachev era to today's Russia.
In many respects, what Russia is doing today in Africa is negative, or I should say not positive, and in fact destructive. They are a country that has been sending armed forces, armed private armies into various African countries, Central African Republic, Mali being just a couple, where they have used private paramilitary services to support and bolster governments, some of which have come into power as a result of coup d'etats. This undermines the sovereignty of African countries and does very little to help improve the security of the nations that these Russian mercenaries, armed military units are providing.
Since so much of the world, many of the world leaders are against the Russian invasion in Ukraine, do you see it kind of as a pendulum swing? And do you think things are going to change in Russia and there could be different kind of Russian influence in Africa again?
I'm not an expert on Russian politics, and so I can't answer that. The thing that I would say is that I hope Russia would play a more responsible political and economic role in Africa, that it ceased to send private military forces into the continent, and that it, in fact, focus on providing development support and investment without strings. But today, it is known mostly for the private military that it is sending around the continent.
Is there anything you want to mention what we're talking about here with Mr. Gorbachev's influence on Africa?
Let me say that his changes in the Soviet Union rippled down into Africa. And for that, I think many should be thankful. The era that he ushered in terms of allowing the collapse of the Soviet Union, also ushered in a period in which there was greater economic freedom, greater political freedom in Africa, in large measure, because the failure of the Soviet Union demonstrated the weakness of the Soviet economic and political models.
That's U.S. Ambassador Johnny Carson, former Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs and Senior Advisor at the United States Institute of Peace Africa Center, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam. Some Indo-Pacific nations find themselves caught between the interests of two rival nations, the U.S. and China. Some countries are trying to balance relations with both, like Indonesia, which is deepening defense ties with the U.S. while trying to avoid repercussions from China, their largest trading partner. VOA's Virginia Gunawan reports.
In the first 2 weeks of August, more than 5,000 troops from 14 countries, including Indonesia and the U.S., participated in Super Garuda Shield military exercises in Indonesia. The U.S. says the annual drill is now one of the largest joint multinational exercises in the Indo-Pacific region. Chinese state media criticized the expanded drill and accused the U.S. of trying to build a NATO-like alliance in the Indo-Pacific. The military drills took place amid heightened tension between the U.S. and China and during a controversial visit by U.S. congressional leaders to Taiwan, a territory Beijing regards as a breakaway province. Southeast Asia expert Brian Harding spoke about the timing of the visit.
Military exercises, complex ones like Garuda Shield between two and more countries, take a very long time to plan. So it truly is a coincidence that this took place just around the time of the Taiwan Strait crisis.
The military drills took place at three locations, including the Riau Islands close to China's so-called Nine-Dash Line that claims territorial rights to various regions in the Pacific. Those claims have not been established under international law. Analysts say, like many countries in the region, Indonesia is caught between appeasing China, its largest trading partner, and its growing relationship with the U.S., which calls for a free and open Indo-Pacific. Indonesia has managed to maintain relations with the two regional rivals. During the Cold War, it adopted the foreign policy of neutrality, dubbed the Free and Active Policy. Even though Indonesia itself continues to shun formal military alliances, it is surrounded by relatively new security groupings, like the Quad, made up of the U.S., Japan, India and Australia, and AUKUS, between the U.S., the U.K. and Australia. The U.S. has also held other joint military exercises in the region, including Balikatan with the Philippines, Cobra Gold with Thailand, and Talisman Sabre with Australia. The RIMPAC naval exercises, also conducted recently, saw the largest maritime exercises in the Indo-Pacific, but excluded China after the 2018 militarization of islands in the South China Sea. The Biden administration is also investing heavily in the region. Last February, the White House approved nearly $14 billion worth of arms sales to Indonesia, including 36 F-15 fighter jets, to support U.S. foreign policy and national security goals in the region. Virginia Gunawan, VOA News in Washington.
Britain will have a new prime minister next week, nearly 2 months after the resignation of Boris Johnson in July, following a series of scandals. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Johnson's successor faces a series of daunting challenges, while Britain allies, including Ukraine, are watching closely.
At 10 Downing Street, the moving vans have come and gone. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is on his way out. Conservative Party members will choose his successor, former Chancellor Rishi Sunak, or current Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who polls suggest is the overwhelming favourite. Their first challenge, the war in Ukraine. Britain has provided around $2.7 billion worth of military aid to Kiev since Russia's invasion in February, second only to the United States. Johnson is hugely popular in Kiev. So will his departure spell a changing relationship? That's highly unlikely under Truss, says Alan Wager, a political analyst at King's College London.
She's also committed to increasing UK defence spending to 3% of gross domestic product and continuing the supply of arms to Ukraine.
Ukraine may be the least complicated of the challenges facing Britain's next prime minister. Domestic gas and electricity prices are set to soar by 80% in October, compounding the post-COVID economic crisis and raising the prospect of an imminent recession. Adam Scorer is the chief executive of the charity National Energy Action.
Families just cannot afford anything close to this. It's a disaster. 10,000 people die every year in the UK directly because of a cold home. That number is going to skyrocket.
Truss has ruled out helping people pay their bills and says tax cuts are the answer.
What's important is that we get the economy growing.
Relations with European neighbours are strained. Asked on the campaign trail if the President of France, a NATO ally, was a friend or foe, Truss gave this answer.
The jury's out, but if I become Prime Minister, I'll judge him on deeds, not words.
Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The World Health Organization UNICEF Global Study of Healthcare Facilities finds half lack basic hygiene services, putting about 3.85 billion people at risk of infection and death. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The study is based on data from 40 countries representing 35% of the world's population. It presents an alarming picture of health facilities that lack water and soap for hand washing, have dirty toilets, and are unable to manage healthcare waste. It says the lack of safe water, sanitation, and basic hygiene services, known as WASH, in healthcare facilities can lead to many preventable deaths. Rick Johnston is WHO lead, WHO UNICEF Joint Monitoring Program for WASH. He says sepsis, a major cause of mortality globally, could be prevented by improving WASH services in healthcare.
It causes about 11 million avoidable deaths each year. And we know that in healthcare settings, sepsis mortality is linked to poor quality of care, including inadequate WASH. Still, today, 670,000 neonatal deaths occur due to sepsis. So there's a huge burden that could be improved right there.
Data show the situation tends to be better in hospitals than in smaller healthcare facilities. The WHO reports the 46 least developed countries lag most behind in hygiene services, with only 32% of healthcare facilities providing WASH services. Johnston says sub-Saharan Africa is the geographic region with the lowest coverage of basic services, about a third lower than globally.
I mentioned hand hygiene services at 51% globally. It's only 38% in sub-Saharan Africa. Water services, 78% globally, only 52% in sub-Saharan Africa. But in sub-Saharan Africa, only 13% of healthcare facilities met the requirement for a basic healthcare service. So, yeah, lots of work to be done in sub-Saharan Africa.
The WHO estimates the cost of achieving universal basic wash services in the 46 least developed countries at less than $10 billion between now and 2030. While that sounds like a lot, WHO officials say it comes to just under $1 per person per year. Officials say that is a fraction of what currently is being spent on healthcare services in those countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, U.S. regulators have authorized updated COVID-19 boosters, the first to directly target today's most common Omicron strain. The move on Wednesday by the Food and Drug Administration tweaks the recipe of shots made by Pfizer and rival Moderna. The hope is that the modified boosters will blunt yet another winter surge. Until now, vaccines have targeted the original coronavirus. The new boosters are half that original recipe and have protection against the newest Omicron versions. Before shots began, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention must recommend who should get the additional dose. CDC advisors will debate that on Thursday. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Authorities in Ethiopia's Tigray region have reported a fresh airstrike on the capital, Mekelle, that they say hit near a hospital and a center for displaced people. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's federal government said in a statement that fighting has spread to the west of Tigray near the border with Sudan. Henry Wilkins reports from Hawassa, Ethiopia.
Ibrahim Gebrselassie, the chief clinical director at Mekelle's Ada Referral Hospital, said on Twitter that there was a drone attack close to midnight Wednesday near Mekelle General Hospital. He said casualties were arriving at Ada Hospital without giving details. Meanwhile, Getachew Reda, a spokesman for the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, said on Twitter that at least three bombs were dropped on Mekelle, with Mekelle Hospital being among the targets. He said there were no conceivable military targets in the area where the attack took place. Due to a telecommunications blackout in Tigray, it was impossible for VOA to confirm the accounts or learn the extent of the casualties. On Wednesday morning, the Ethiopian government issued a statement saying the TPLF had invaded the Amhara region near the border with neighbouring Sudan. Reda denied the allegation, saying the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is making up stories. A five-month ceasefire in Ethiopia's civil war came to an end last week, dashing hopes for peace talks. Each side has blamed the other for the renewed fighting. Meanwhile, Sudan's government has summoned Ethiopia's ambassador to Khartoum over an assertion he made that the Ethiopian military shot down a plane carrying weapons from Sudanese airspace. Sudan says the allegation was unfounded. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Hawassa, Ethiopia.
Thank you, Henry. And one of the largest conferences for the cryptocurrency and blockchain community was recently held in Austin, Texas, attracting a wide spectrum of people involved. Michelle Quinn gets the scoop.
James Wisdom, a Chicago art instructor and tattoo artist, regularly goes to his local grocery store to buy Bitcoin, also known by its trading symbol, BTC.
Being able to go to CoinMe and buy BTC, especially where I get my groceries, is, I think, the future of capitalism.
While cryptocurrencies are not widely used to buy things, that has not curtailed their appeal. Crypto has inspired many first-time investors, especially those skeptical of traditional investing. Steve Leakey told his parents to invest in crypto when he was 10 years old.
Still pretty young.
His parents didn't take his advice, but Steve's uncle was buying crypto, so he did too. Riding the crypto roller coaster wasn't easy.
It was super hard because every day I found myself checking it, found myself, you know, looking where I'm at, and just that mental toll was a lot.
Government regulators are raising alarms about scams and investors who have lost millions. Crypto supporters and skeptics are waiting to see what government regulators may do next. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Hi, this is Rick Pantaleo. Space junk expert John Crosides of the University of Buffalo joins me this weekend for the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. we will discuss the growing threat of space junk to humans in space, such as those at the International Space Station, as well as all operating satellites and other spacecraft. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including President Biden hit the road with his Inflation Reduction Act now in place. He looks to boost the political fortunes of key Democratic candidates while persuading voters in swing states that they shouldn't back Republicans in the upcoming midterm elections. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. The stakes for Angola's elections. Angola's Electoral Commission declared the ruling MPLA, which has retained power for nearly 50 years, the winner of that oil and diamond-rich nation's recent elections, giving President João Lourenço a second term amid allegations of fraud by opposition UNITA, which nonetheless gained a significant number of seats in parliament. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Nwafor in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nearly 20 million people living in the Horn of Africa are facing a crisis of food insecurity. The region has suffered four consecutive droughts and is looking at a fifth come October. The Horn region has two rainy seasons per year, said USAID Administrator Samantha Power, who recently visited some of the most seriously affected regions in Somalia and Kenya. This is the first time in history, she stressed at a recent talk here in Washington, that the Horn of Africa has suffered four consecutive failed rainy seasons.
Today, pasture lands are turning to dust, and in near biblical scenes, weakened farm animals are dying of disease. To date, at least 7 million livestock have already died in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia. There just isn't enough water to quench their thirst or enough grass to feed them.
Through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, the government of the United States is providing critical humanitarian assistance totaling $1.2 billion to the three most severely affected countries in the region, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia. Early humanitarian investments are critical to saving lives. In Ethiopia this year alone, the United States is providing $668 million in support of more than 8.1 million people whose survival is threatened by the historic drought. In Kenya, the drought has pushed more than 4 million people to the edge of starvation, with communities in the arid and semi-arid land countries having been hit the hardest. By the end of May, some 70% of crops were reported lost, along with at least 2.4 million head of livestock. USAID is providing to the people of Kenya nearly $255 million in emergency food and other critical humanitarian and development assistance. And in Somalia, 7.1 million people are affected by this crisis. More than 3 million agricultural animals have died, and 1.4 million children are facing acute malnutrition through the end of the year. USAID is providing $476 million in critical humanitarian and development aid to the people of Somalia, bringing the U.S. total assistance for this year to more than $707 million. This humanitarian aid illustrates the United States' continuing commitment to the welfare of the people of Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia. We urge other partner governments, said Administrator Power, to join us in significantly increasing their own commitments to prevent widespread famine and millions of deaths.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.